Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Kayla Itzinas.
Kayla Itzinas. I'm Kayla Itzinas, and I have been training a global community of women since 2009. I've created a brand new podcast, Sweat Daily, to help you level up your life and reach your health and well-being goals. From fitness tips to food that fuels you, meditation to motivation, we've got you covered. Sweat Daily, the happiest, healthiest, and most confident version of you awaits. Available on Apple Podcasts and wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the podcast.
Hello.
Hello. I'm Peter. And who are you?
I'm Gary.
And here we are at your home again.
I know, we keep doing it here. Polly chucked you out or something.
She often wants to, yeah. We've got a really exciting, we've got an interesting podcast coming up. It's no excitement really. It's got an interesting title. It's called Fife and Forfar Yeomanry.
Why are we waiting?
Why? No, that's enough of that. They're waiting to go into action. The last episode we did on the 5D4Fars was looking at the early time when they were in Ireland. And then suddenly they were a recce regiment, weren't they? Or just a recce regiment? Just. They were a recce regiment whose role was to scout ahead of the division, which an important role, but it's changing, isn't it? They're going to become an armoured regiment. So what does that entail? Did they stay in Ireland? No. Where did they go?
Well, they moved back to England on the 5th of July 1941, and they moved to the seaside town of Whitby in Yorkshire as their new home. I believe it's famous for its fish and chips. Or is that Dracula? One of the two. Fish and chips and Dracula spring to mind.
Yeah.
Now, any hopes or fears of an immediate active service deployment were thwarted or allayed, depends on your point of view, I suppose, by this change in role, as it meant that, in effect, their training's got to start all over again.
Oh, no. And what tanks are they going to... Because the Mark 7... Was it Mark 6?
Mark 6B.
Oh, right. Sorry. Yeah. That's not going to be what they're on. That's a reconnaissance tank. But so what are they going to have?
Well, they get a mixture of Valentine and Matilda tanks. Now, they really didn't know at this point that this training would end up lasting for a further 3 long years.
Hence why are we waiting... Now, who do they join? They join 29th Armoured Brigade. Who's in that, Gary? There's a quick test for you.
Well, there was the 23rd Hussars.
Fine body of men.
The 24th Lancers.
Fine body of men.
The 2nd Fife and Forfar Yeomanry themselves.
Our heroes.
And the motorised infantry of the 8th Rifle Brigade.
Now, there's another armoured brigade. That's the 30th Armoured Brigade. They're gathered there at Helmsley, close by. Then the 11th Support Group was at Moulton, also close by. And these units together, the support group's a mixture of artillery and things, all the ancillary units. And there's also got the armoured cars of 27 Lancers. And there's lots of things. All together, this is the 11th Armoured Division, which had been formed, Gary, in December 1940. How big is it in total? How do we get an idea of the size of it across to people?
Well, one way would be to think about how many tanks they actually had. And they can deploy some 350 tanks and 3 motorised battalions of infantry.
So they're a powerful force. A powerful force. Who's in charge?
Now, interestingly, they were commanded by...
I just remembered who's in charge.
Major General Percy Hobart. An inspired, but some would say controversial, choice as divisional commander.
So what's his background? In 1934, he was brigadier in charge of the first ever permanent British Armoured Brigade, and he'd been working hard developing his own theories on the practice of armoured warfare, how it was to be done. He's a competent soldier, really competent, but there's another side to him, isn't there? And I know you want to make some personal remarks here, so I'll let you get on with it.
Well, Hobart had acquired the reputation of being difficult, characterised by both his unconventionality and an evil temper, which led to several prolonged feuds with senior officers, which would return to haunt him. After a series of disputes with high command, he was shuffled off into premature retirement early in 1940. Now, guess what he does?
I don't know.
His reaction was to join the newly formed local defence volunteers as a lance corporal.
Gary! He's following in your... Well, no, he's precursing your footsteps.
Well, he's done the reverse. I started as a lance corporal, but in civilian life, had a couple of colonels working for me.
So you were a brigadier,
yeah. Now, as the Blitzkrieg raged in France and the Low Countries in May 1940, Britain's foremost expert in tank warfare was busy preparing for the defence of his hometown of Chipping Campden.
An important location, no doubt. But is it really where you want your foremost expert in tank warfare?
No, and in August 1940, a press campaign against the decision to retire Hobart reached the ears of our hero, Winston Churchill.
All right.
Now, as a result, Hobart was re-enlisted and posted to the 11th Armour Division in 1941.
To command it, yeah. And he does stamp his mark on it. He leaves his mark wherever he goes. That's one of the... Oh, yeah. He's not always in good health, but often when people are in poor health, they don't have sort of that zing and zest. But what's he like?
Oh, no, he had energy and commitment to spare, driving his division onwards and upwards to attain new heights of efficiency.
Now, let's get back to our heroes, the 2nd 54 First. Now, they've got A, B and C. They're the Sabre squadrons, and they're equipped with the new Valentine tanks. A few Matildas are issued to the headquarters troops. Now, let's talk about the Valentine. What would you say, if you're thinking about the Valentine, how would you describe it? We're not experts, but we want to preface this by saying neither of us are experts on any of this.
Or anything.
Or anybody. Give us an idea about the Valentine.
Well, the Valentine was a typical British tank of the period in that it was designed in a rush as a stopgap when the British had finally realised that they lacked any medium tanks and war was looming, Pete.
So what's the plus side?
Well, it was a good-looking tank. It was a bit quicker than the Matilda, quite spacious and comfortable for the three-man crew. It also had reasonable armour protection, at least by the standards of the early war. Now, best of all, it was mechanically reliable.
What's the big negative, though? I can sense them. You haven't mentioned the armament. Is that adequate?
Well, that was the big negative. It was totally inadequate. 40mm, that's a two-pounder gun, which left it outranged and outpunched by its German contemporaries. Yet, compared to the visibly obsolescent Mark 6B, the Valentine was a real tank.
Yeah, it's all a matter of... It was much better than the Mark 6B. And it exuded a sort of untrammelled power to those who don't know any what they're doing. Now, one of those, I'm going to read a quote from Trooper Ron Forbes, 4 Troop, B Squadron. And he said this: there's something about driving a tank. You feel as if you've got a powerful vehicle under you. On these schemes, you were driving over rough ground, and it was like being on the Big Dipper sometimes. I just enjoyed it. They were good to drive. You were on your own. You didn't have a co-driver. You were sitting in the middle of the tank. Your view was fairly restricted, as it always is in a tank. You just had your two levers, your gear lever, your accelerator. Only a two-pounder gun and a B-sound machine gun. Useless as far as modern weapons go, but against the stuff the Germans had, they were useless. And that's he summed it up there pretty well. He enjoyed it, he liked it, but he was just getting, you know, later on he realises they're just no good.
Now that summer, the 2nd, 5th and 4th Fire Yeomanry were kept busy training in their new role. Individual skills had to be acquired and thoroughly mastered. Then the Valentine commanders, gunners and drivers, had to mould themselves into an efficient tank crew, working together as a seamless whole.
Now, it's sort of the British Army way, isn't it? You start at individual level, how do you drive? Then you become a tank crew, and then you start to have small-scale exercises as a troop, a squadron, and then how does it all finish? How does it culminate? It's the standard. I think it's a standard pattern of military training now, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, after a series of small-scale exercises on the Yorkshire Moors, the annual training peaked in October 1941 with the eponymous Exercise Percy.
Named after the governor, eh?
I'm going to read what Sergeant Alex Gilchrist of HQ Squadron, he's been promoted. I think he was Lance Corporal.
Yeah, they do get promoted.
Yeah, yeah. Since our last podcast.
Sadly, it's you that didn't get
promoted. Oh, yeah, that's true. Again, I did the reverse. Now, he's of the HQ Squadron. He says, "We did some wonderful schemes and I became aware of what it was like to go into battle. We were properly organised. We were taking commands, coming down the chain of command. When the umpires told you your tank had been knocked out because you had taken up a silly position on the moors, when you should have gone hull down so that the tank commander could see, but they couldn't see you. When the umpire came along and said, 'You're out, you're killed,' for the first time you began to realise what it was all about."
Now, it's the interviews show it up, and the regiment history of the time. So they didn't shine the second Fife and four Fire Yeomanry on Exercise Percy, and with a result that the colonel of the time, Lieutenant Colonel Edward Sword, is moved on, as they say. Who replaces him?
Well, he's replaced in October 1941 by Lieutenant Colonel George Cooper, and he takes over command of the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry.
Now, who's he? Give me a description. I'm thinking of you as except that you're a dwarf and he's tall, but describe him.
Well, he was another regular officer, a big man, over 6 foot tall, and an ex-army boxing champion. Now, that had left him with a distinctive damaged nose. He proved to be a real character, as he had also been a pre-war racing driver and would race about in his Humber staff car.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. He was actually arrested for speeding, Kerry. Well, how do you think the lads responded to this? Because he also was known as a strict disciplinarian. He actually brought in guardsmen instructors to sort of improve the overall level of discipline and drill. But how do you think the men responded to the overall package? Disciplinarian but character.
Despite that, he was nevertheless popular with the men. They appreciated his idiosyncrasies.
Well, pronounced that perfectly.
Now, bigger changes were afoot as the whole of the 11th Armoured Division was recast and reorganised to reflect the lessons learnt in the North African campaign.
It had become evident in North Africa that they needed more armoured divisions, but they had to have a change in their composition. The Germans, they'd already reduced the armoured element within their panzer divisions, and the British now follow suit. What they need is a mixture, so they need more infantry close at hand to deal with any strong German defensive positions that might bar their way, or to establish a bridgehead across a river, not in the West. Not in the Western Desert, but, you know, other place. And they also had realised they need far more artillery. Well, now, we've talked about this when we were talking about the South Knots Hussars, who are an artillery regiment. It becomes more and more crucial that concentrated artillery fire, and that means you have to concentrate the batteries to get that concentrated fire. So what reforms are made to sort of reflect these things?
Well, as a result, the 30th Armour Brigade's dispatched to form the nucleus of a new armoured division, and a whole new lorried infantry brigade, the 159th Brigade, was added, and extra artillery units.
So basically, an armoured division is perversely now going to have more infantry. It is a mixture now. It's going to have an armoured brigade, it's going to have a lorried brigade, and it's going to have more artillery. So where do they go to next?
Well, in May 1942, the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry moved to the Hove area.
Ooh.
By this time, they were being re-equipped with the Crusader cruiser tank, another typically British series of tank design compromises.
Yeah, this is classic, isn't it? And it's one step forward and two steps back from the Valentine in many ways. It's a cruiser tank, so what do you think that means?
Well, certainly faster.
But it had even thinner armour. And what gun did it have? Any
Still only had the 2-pounder pop gun as a main armament. Although some 6-pounder versions did begin to appear later in that summer.
Yeah, not many. But there's something else that absolutely puts a bloody cap on it as far as the lads are concerned. What's that?
Well, it's far less mechanically reliable.
So this is... So what do you think the lads have to do?
Oh, they've just got to make the best of it.
Now, the continuous programme is going on of armoured brigade and divisional training all across the South Downs. They were not only training as a tank regiment, but they're practising their liaison with the infantry, artillery and recce regiment. And this culminates in a 14-day extravaganza. This is Exercise Tiger. Whose brainwave is this?
Well, that's the creation of Lieutenant General Bernard Montgomery of South Eastern Command.
We've heard of him, haven't we?
It was the largest exercise held in Britain up to that date, and it involved over 100,000 troops stretching its tentacles out all across southern England.
Ooh. Now, how do you think the lads are feeling with all this training?
Well, by the end of these exercises, there's a growing confidence that they were at last ready for deployment to the shooting war. Yet, still no active service seemed to be on the horizon.
More training, more training, more training. Now, the composition of the regiment itself is gradually changing. Why do you think it's changing?
Well, there's a number of English drafts begin to swell rapidly.
And that's because there's more English than there are Scots. So if you're looking at the army as a whole, there's always going to be English drafts sent to units when they start to it's just inevitable. Who should we pick? Who should we look at?
Well, amongst them was Roy Valence, who came from Suffolk. But he'd worked as a printer in London pre-war. He was initially posted as a spare crew member to A Squadron, and it would become his home, but it wasn't immediately obvious. And this is what Trooper Roy Valence, 4 Troop A Squadron, had to say. They were all Scotsmen. There were very few Sassenach members there at all. I was the only English chap in my troop. So life was quite difficult. I didn't know what they were saying after time. I hadn't heard many Scotsmen talking in my young life then. They seemed to talk very rapidly, and they had a lot of slang which I'd never been acquainted with. They seemed to not really welcome Sassenachs. Naturally, my leg was pulled a bit. Quite friendly, provided you take it with a smile on your face.
So not friendly at all, no. Really. Now, one chap I really like is a rather difficult... The interview's great fun. He's a difficult man in many ways. He's also very amusing. I liked him a lot. It's John Gray. He'd worked in a cooperative store in London. He was a convinced Labour Party activist, and his father before him was a trade union activist, and he'd actually been almost a conscientious objector before he decided to do his bit. And you're going to be John Gray, and this is a typical quote from him.
I got a card inviting me to join His Majesty's Armed Forces. I went to the Label Exchange with this card, was given a medical, and you were asked what service that you'd like to go into. I said, I would like to go into the Navy. If I can't go in the Navy, I'll go in the Air Force. I'll even go as a rear gunner. But if I have to go in the Army, I don't want to go in the tanks. The fear I had all the time of burning to death, that was what frightened me. Where did I finish up? If I said, please put me in the tanks, I would have been in the Navy as a cook or something.
He was put in the tanks. That is classic army, isn't it? You're aware of that from your time. It never changes, really. So what's going on? August 1942, the second Fife and Four Fires moved to a proper Nissen hutted camp at Farnham All Saints in sunny Suffolk. Now, what's going on? By late 1942, they're starting to think that the 11th Armoured Division would be sent out as a reinforcement to North Africa. Now, what does that trigger?
Well, there's still some questions over Percy Hobart's state of health, and at this point he's replaced by Major General Montague Burrows.
Right. We don't hear much from him in this story, but Percy Hobart had done a great job. I think we all agree with that. And he goes on to do an even better job in some sense of forming the 79th Armoured Division. What are they famous from? What do you remember of our trip to the Funnies?
Oh, yeah, for Normandy.
Yeah, the special tanky things.
Now, in mid-October 1942, instead of North Africa, They moved to Chippenham Camp near Newmarket.
Is that like North Africa?
It's very like North Africa.
Sort of bleak desert area inhabited by people who wear Bedouin clothes.
Now, on the 20th of October, the 2nd 5th and 4th Files got their new commanding officer with the arrival of Colonel Alex Scott, previously of the 5th, 6th Inniskilling Dragoon Guards.
Now, he's the man who's going to take them into action, so it's perhaps worth thinking a bit about him. Scott is generally considered to be an intelligent officer. Now, you often considered officers to be intelligent, didn't you?
I did. Although he was slow to make his mind up while he weighed things up.
That's not a bad characteristic, is it, Shirley? Making your mind up before you know what's going on, is that a good idea sometimes? Not always. It's a speed of thought, and it's interesting that. When he did make his mind up, I think he took a proper decision and he took firm action. What would you say?
Well, like me, his personality was perhaps dogged by a slight shyness.
You won an international shyness competition once.
As some of his men considered him not to be a mixer and overly conscious of his rank.
Yeah, that's oral history for you. But actually, I mean...
Well, he was a colonel.
He was a colonel, and privates don't mix, troopers don't really mix with colonels. So
I do.
You do now, yeah. Ah, the list of your colonel chums.
Now, one of the new officers attached to the regiment was Charlie Workman, who joined at this time. Originating from Glasgow, Workman had been working as a law apprentice before serving as a ranker with a searchlight battery. His potential was recognised and he was commissioned into the Royal Armoured Corps after attending Sandhurst. His welcome on arrival at the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry was slightly eccentric and in some ways was a reminder of the pre-war regime. And this is what 2nd Lieutenant Charlie Workman of 1 Troop C Squadron had to say.
I was wheeled in to meet Alec Scott, the colonel. His first words were, "Well, welcome to the regiment. You've had a long journey. Have a drink." I drew myself up and said, "I don't drink, Colonel." I saw a little smile. I wondered how long this will last. That's obviously what the colonel was thinking. "Oh," he said, "have a tea or something." I was then posted to C Squadron. Alistair Nairn, who was a squadron leader, and he said, "Do you ride?" I said, "No." And he said, "Well, what are you doing here?" "Well, I'm interested in the horses in that engine." I didn't take it amiss. One of the great things about Sandhurst was it gave you terrific self-assurance. I reckon I could have run the army by this time. When he says that, the horse in the engine, the tank engine, that's what he's on about. But it's interesting, the overconfidence of a very young second lieutenant. Because as we know, that's just what they're like.
Now, so a very important influence on Workman was the senior NCOs within his troop. They had far more practical experience and guile than any callow young officer, wet beyond the ears and fresh out of Sandhurst.
There seems to be a venom in your voice, though.
Now, this is what 2nd Lieutenant Charlie Workman goes on to say.
"My two sergeants, Christie and Hutton, were both real fifers. A Scotsman who is a fifer is a particular brand, rather like an Englishman would regard a Yorkshireman, a sort of craggy type with a very particular approach to life. Both of them had been in the Fife and Four Fire Yeomanry for years. They were older than I was. I could see when they got on a tank and the way they handled their tanks that these guys knew what it was all about. We were out in a wood and I was in my tent and I heard Christie say to wee Hughie Hatton, 'Oh, where's that young Charlie fellow? He's a new officer. I just didn't really say that, Gary. We'll have to train him, same as the rest.' I don't think tact is a feature of a fifer. They were not into tact. They were into blunt truth."
Do you enjoy that? Now, Scottish, English or Welsh, they all began to mould together as a unit. Real or imagined, grievances were gradually smoothed out as they realised that they had far more in common than the minor cultural differences that divided
them. Yeah, that's true. And they do. They're starting to blend together. But what's the underlying theme? It's training, 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 training. It just really never seems to end, does it? And lunch. You do like a lunch, don't you?
I like a lunch. Now, the exercises was as realistic as they could manage, and there was often scant respect paid to local farmers' crops and fences. And once more, you're going to tell us what 2nd Lieutenant Charlie Workman has to say.
"Attack such and such a village. The opposing enemy will be another regiment. You were given an indication of where they were, and their idea was to ambush you. That meant reading a map. Am I in a valley?" What do I find across the hill? You literally went where you wanted to go. If that meant knocking down a wall and planting yourself in the middle of a cornfield, that's precisely what you did. At that stage, you didn't have to respect walls.
Mm. Now, there were, however, moments of great comedy value, normally triggered by the wireless system, which demanded extreme care if individual wireless operators and tank commanders were not to accidentally broadcast their ribald comments.
Now, I better explain that, because what it is it's one mic and you're either on the intercom talking to the lads in the tank or you're talking to the whole regiment. And you're going to tell us the experiences of Trooper Roy Valance, 4 Troop A Squadron.
Coming back in from an exercise, the whole regiment was on the net and the CO came over the air to the squadron leaders and said, practice picking up targets on the way back to practice the gunners. Then you heard A Squadron leader telling his squadron to do this. B Squadron, C Squadron, a very lengthy business. Then at the end you heard a Scottish voice come over saying, swing the effing turret round a bit, Jock. A silly old bastard wants us to practice gunnery. The commander, thinking he was speaking on the intercom, was speaking on the A set, which everybody heard. The air was blue from the colonel after that. And now we're going to take a break for an important message from our sponsors.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
Well, I hope it wasn't Angersoll again, Pete.
Well, that would really rub it in, wouldn't it? Now, so there they are. We were talking about the exercises and the intercom and all the rest of it. The minor humour that arises in any soldier's business. But then there comes the news they've all been waiting for. What's that? What is it, Gary?
They were told that they would be leaving on the 22nd of February, 1943.
Where are they going?
Well, men are sent on embarkation leave and then the tanks were dispatched off to Glasgow, ready for the long voyage on transport ships to
the Middle East. Oh, Gary, the second 5 for 4 for Yeomanry. They're on their way to war at last. You got the number of years wrong. It wasn't 3 or 4 years in waiting. It was just 1 or 2. You've got it all wrong.
Now, this is what Trooper Leslie Gibson of the Anti-Aircraft Troop HQ Squadron had to say. I moved the soft vehicles up from Chippenham. We stopped at Doncaster, and it was then pretty obvious we were going north to Glasgow. Then we were turned back. The tanks actually went on the ship. Well, according to the Brigadier, we were disappointed, but I don't think the men were all that disappointed. He gave us 7 days leave to let us do what we wanted to hide our disappointment.
Now, the regimental historian, he also refers to the regiment as subsiding like a deflated balloon. But, do you know, and this is human nature, the men are a lot more ambivalent, aren't they? And I think this quote from Trooper Ron Forbes, 4 Squadron, 4 Troop B Squadron, why do I keep getting things wrong?
Because you're you.
Yeah, thanks, Gary. And he says this, you did feel unwanted, a bit annoyed. We always said they were keeping the 5 and 4 fast to bull up the tanks and drive into Berlin. These are the sort of thoughts that went through your mind. Why was it that 4 years after we were mobilised that we'd never got into any action at all? Personally, and this is the bit, isn't it? Personally, I was quite happy. I'd have been quite happy driving around the Yorkshire moors for the whole of the war. I'm not one of these types bursted to win a VC. And that's the human nature. Because, of course, you wanted to test yourself. You wanted to do your bit for your country. You wanted to see what war is. But you're also scared. Because, of course, you might get killed.
So why was the deployment cancelled?
Why?
Well, it wasn't a vendetta.
It was a vendetta.
Against the 2nd, 5th and 4th Army Yeomanry. It was a change in policy as regards the whole of the 11th Armour Division.
Hey, what's changed? Well, what is it, Gary? Explain to me.
Well, they had been intended for North Africa, but the fighting in Tunisia in early 1943 had indicated that what was really needed in that theatre of war was more infantry and not another armoured division.
So what do the men have to do? Well, it's back to training, routine training.
And lunch.
And more and lunch. Sorry, Gary. What about breakfast?
No, just lunch. Now, more and more men are beginning to wonder, what's the point of it all?
What is the point?
In such circumstances, their minds could easily begin to wander into non-military pursuits.
My mind often wanders into non-military pursuits. So, June 43, it's a bloody never-ending tour of Britain, isn't it, really? They seem to be getting around everywhere. So where'd they go this time?
Well, they settle into a camp just outside Rudston, a small village some 5 miles from Bridlington in North Yorkshire. Seaside town again, Bridlington.
Yeah.
Now, when the weather worsened, they moved into billets in Bridlington.
Now, that's all... That's obviously, a move's important, but what's really important about this time? What's really important, and that is the arrival of the weapon they'd go to war in. What is it, Gary?
It's a full complement of Sherman tanks.
Ooh.
Now, any tank's always a compromise as the designers strive to attain a balance of the desirable but incompatible concepts of firepower, armour protection, speed, manoeuvrability, and mechanical reliability.
Now, at a certain stage of technology, you can't have all of them. Don't you remember with the Invincible? We talked about this with HMS Invincible, or the battlecruiser. You can't have it all. And everything's going to be a compromise. Now, what's happening to the British? Why are they? It's an American tank. Why are the British using an American tank?
Well, they've got themselves into a state of confusion in their twin desires for a fast cruiser tank with anti-tank armour-piercing firepower and a heavier infantry close support tank with heavy armour and a high explosive shell-compatible gun.
Well, now, why are they confused? Well, some people aren't confused. Who's the person who's got most experience in tank warfare in the British at this stage? Because this is practical experience now. This isn't Hobart anymore. This is Montgomery.
Yeah, it's Montgomery, and it's based on his experiences in the Western Desert.
So what does he think?
Well, he doesn't see the need for such a dichotomy and demanded... You are so cruel to me. And demanded a single tank capable of fulfilling both roles. And saw the mechanically reliable American Sherman M4 with the 75mm dual-purpose gun as the nearest thing to that ideal then available.
So 75mm is bigger than 40.
It's 35mm bigger. Oh,
your math skills are just...
I might not be able to say dichotomy.
Dichotomy. Well, I think the pundits will have enjoyed that. Now, is the Sherman a successful compromise in our view? Again, we are outsiders looking in. We're not experts, are we? But from our non-expert opinion, what do we think?
Well, the Sherman sort of falls between the two stools. The armour was too thin for a true infantry close support role, while in any tank versus tank duel, it ended up being both undergunned and under-armoured in comparison to the rather more complete new German tanks, such as the Panther and the Tiger.
That's a bit all in the future, isn't it? That's comment. It's fair comment, isn't it? It's all in the future for the lads of the 2nd 554 so. So what do you think they thought as they gathered round their new Shermans, the Sherman tank? I think the overall, and I listened to a lot of people talking about it, the overall reaction was positive. And just to give us an idea, we've got a summary from our friend Trooper Roy Valance of 4 Troop 8 Squadron.
The Crusaders went and we got the new American Sherman tanks. We had one or two per squadron and we all did training on them. Our first impression was that it was a giant tank, much bigger than what we'd had in the past. For a start, the crew was 5 and it was very high to climb up on until one got used to it. It was very modern looking compared with our old Crusaders, more streamlined and smoother lines. The 75mm gun looked much, much more powerful than the old 2-pounders we'd been used to. With a coaxial Browning 30mm and a hull Browning 30mm in the co-driver's compartment, on the cupola was a .50 machine gun. It had the usual 2-inch bomb thrower in the roof for the smoke. Very comfortable inside, quite spacious, one could stand up quite easily. The seats were adjustable. The engine was a 5-bank Chrysler.
Basically, car engines, all banked together.
Very reliable.
Now let's look at it's a big step forward on the Crusader. And what do you think? So let's go through what we're talking about here. They got one or two per troop, then they got all the rest. That's what we're talking about. So what's the initial impression? It's what Valance said. It's a big beast. It's more than 8 feet high. It weighing in at 34 tons. Reasonable top speed, about 26 miles per hour. That's big. What do you think the gunners thought?
Well, they certainly appreciated the destructive potential of the medium velocity 75mm gun. That boasted a range of over 10,000 yards, and it had some genuine hitting power.
And it's just much better than a bloody pop gun, the 2-pounder. And that's all they'd had on most of the Crusaders, the Valentines and the Matilda. So, yeah, internally, he mentioned it, didn't he? Internally, room to breathe. American tanks have got more room inside them. Spacious, comfortable. What are British tanks like?
Well, they're cramped. And as a result, you know, less functional.
The British tanks are functional.
Less functional.
Right. I entirely endorse your remarks.
Dichotomy.
So they're sort of functional and not functional.
In a way.
Yeah, it's true. The armour, 2.5-inch frontal armour, 1.5-inch of side armour, seemed a lot at the time. We'll be coming back to that do you think people knew if you just come into a tank, what do you think your impressions are? Do you think you realise the faults?
No, of course not. You know, we're going to hear from Gordon Fiddler, who'd previously been an electrician's apprentice in Newbury. And like many, he was blissfully unaware of the penetration capabilities of German guns. And as a result, he felt a sense of real security in his magnificent new tank.
Well, of course he did. And experience only would tell them, wouldn't it? So you're going to give a quote from Gordon Fiddler. He was in A Squadron.
I felt that being in a tank was marvellous. Nobody could get me in here. This is really why I wanted to go into the tanks. Nobody would touch me in here. We'd heard of bigger guns, but I could never imagine AP, he means armour piercing, shot penetrating a tank. At the beginning, I was quite happy to be in a tank regiment because I thought we were immune from being knocked out. I don't think you could imagine an AP shell going through one side and out the other or setting fire to it.
Oh, yeah, well, we'll come to all that. Now, again, they're going to go through a new tank. What do they have to do? They've got to do all the training again. So individual training, their individual roles. So what do they have to do next?
Well, they've got to be welded together, as you described it earlier, as a crew.
Then they've got the troop exercises, the squadron exercises. They're building up. And one of the big exercises was that Exercise Blackcock, where they actually have the pleasure of playing the enemy. These exercises are meant to be getting increasingly realistic, aren't they?
Yeah, they're not only testing their military skills, but their endurance levels as well, so that the men were on iron rations in field conditions. And once more, you're going to relay what Second Lieutenant Charlie Workman has to say.
Blackcock was realistic. They got us all together and they explained that in this exercise, we would do exactly what we'd do for real. In other words, if we had to go through a wall, knock down the side of a barn and sight our tanks in the middle of a field of wheat, that was precisely what we would do. They explained the maximum damage that could be inflicted by the division. You're talking about 200 tanks milling around. It had been calculated and they had arranged for that amount of extra food to be brought from America so that one should have no compunction about putting your tanks where they should be. Bit of mispronunciation by
me. Compunction?
Yeah, compunction.
Dichotomy.
Dichotomy. Sausage.
Now, the 11th Armour Division were undergoing a series of changes. The most important one was in December 1943 with the arrival of a new divisional commander in the form of Major General Philip, known as Pip, Roberts.
Now, he's a relatively young and vigorous officer. Listen to this promotion, Gary. Something sadly absent from your own military career. He was only the adjutant, which I presume is a captain, of the 6th Royal Tank Regiment when the war broke out back in 39. Well, how had he done? Well, he rocketed through the ranks and he built up an unparalleled expertise in armoured warfare, which led to him being promoted as an acting Major General at just, guess how old, Gary?
104.
Now, 37 years old. And that's the age he was when he was put in to command the 11th Armoured Division. I think that's amazing. Now, who's in command of the brigade that the 54 Fires are in?
Well, the 29th Armoured Brigade also had a change as Brigadier Charles Roscoe Harvey took over command. Now, Roscoe Harvey was commissioned in 1920 into the 10th Royal Hussars, who were then still a horsed cavalry regiment. He devoted much of his time as a subaltern to his stellar career as a jockey, even participating in the Grand National, Peter Aintree.
Did you win in the recent Grand National?
No, lost heavily. It was then, when riding overweight, he picked up and subsequently adopted the nickname of Roscoe.
Oh, where's that come from? Because I originally thought that was his name. I genuinely did. But it's actually, his name isn't Roscoe, is it?
It's after Roscoe Fatty Arbuckle, the film star of the 1920s.
He had an unfortunate end to his career, which we're not going to talk about. But
well, mainly because we don't know anything about it, Pete.
No, we've got an inkling about it.
Now, on arriving at the 29th Armour Brigade, he made his presence felt in no uncertain fashion.
I love this quote. This is a real character's quote. It does, I fear, listeners of a delicate nature, feature swearing. So Gary's chosen to do this one.
And this is what Brigadier Roscoe Harvey of 29th Armoured Brigade has to say. The first day in my office, I was surprised that nobody came to see me. And I told my brigade major so. He said, "Well, sir, the red light was on outside your door." I asked him what the hell he meant by a red light. He told me that when the light was on, it meant that the brigadier did not want to be disturbed. So I said, "You will now smash that red light. Anybody who wants to visit me can always do so. If for some reason I don't want to see them, I'll tell them to fuck off."
And he's a real character. And as this goes on, you'll find more about him. There's someone else who arrives around about this time. A really significant arrival in the sense that he's only a young officer. He's only a lieutenant. But he becomes, in my view, my view comes from them, the most renowned tank commander in the whole regiment. Who is he, Gary?
Well, he is William Steele Brownlee. And he was born in Greenock, which is just outside Glasgow, I think, in 1923, and had been educated at the Greenock Academy. As a schoolboy, he had falsified his age to join the local defence volunteers on their formation in June 1940. And indeed, he was even promoted to the dizzy heights of Lance. There's a lot of Lance corporals in this.
A lot of people getting promoted to
it. Yeah, where he found himself giving orders to his science master, who was a mere private.
I think that's great. It's also a good thing. That's interesting, yeah. What does he go on to do?
Well, he goes on to study engineering at Glasgow University, where he would soon find himself struggling to keep up. It was a sandwich course, so he was attached to an engineering factory helping manufacture landing craft.
Eventually, it gets too much for him. He can't. So in August 1942, he volunteers to join the Royal Armoured Corps. Usual basic training, and then he went to Sandhurst and was commissioned as a second lieutenant. Now, he's always known, his name is William, but he's always known, and we will know him henceforth as Steele Brownlee mostly. He very rarely uses his first name. How would you describe him as a character?
Well, he was described as a real live wire, bright and cheerful, with a dry sense of humour. He had to have a dry sense of humour because he joined them at Bridlington. On the 13th of February 1944. And you're going to read a quote from Lieutenant Steele Brownlee of 4 Troop A Squadron.
I was wheeled in to see the CO, Colonel Alex Scott, who sat at his desk and looked me in the eye for a full minute before saying anything. I looked straight back. At least that's my version. After all the training and the bullshit, it was great to be in a real regiment. Moreover, everything was aimed at being ready to cross the channel as part of the 11th Armoured Division and help put an end to the ghastly war. Now, so there's different commanders coming in at all levels, at divisional, brigade and colonel.
What's the collective noun for a group of commanders? It's a bevy, I think you've described them as.
I have in the past, yes, but, you know. There's another huge preparatory exercise. What's this one called?
This one's called Exercise Eagle and was designed to be as realistic as possible in recreating active service conditions.
It's not all, though, is it?
No, the tanks also went a couple of times to conduct a live firing practice at Kirkcudbrightshire Rangers. I can't say that.
Neither can I. I think it's more Kirkcudbright. No, I can't say it either. Scottish friends. I'm sure our Scottish friends will help us out.
Yeah. Now, during the firing, Jack Edwards was given a first inkling of what lay ahead for so many of them. And this is what Trooper Jack Edwards of 4 Troop B Squadron has to say.
Aye. One of the Shermans caught fire. Why, I don't know. Whether it was oil on the engines, lack of cleaning or what, I don't know. But the engine caught fire. They were messing about with fire extinguishers. They couldn't get out of the tank because it was about 18 inches deep in mud everywhere. Another tank rang alongside and all the crew jumped off. The order was move at least 20 yards away from the burning tank. So we did. That's when I saw my first brewed-up Sherman. All the ammunition started burning, bursting and exploding. It was a terrible sight. I didn't realise the same sort of thing might happen when a shell came through the tank. Wow. And it did. This is what lies ahead for so many of them. Now, what else is happening? Well, they're getting some more specialist tanks. There's one that's really, but they get an anti-aircraft tank, they get a bulldozer tank. But there's one that's really important. What's that, Gary?
That's the Sherman Firefly variant, which had a much more powerful 3-inch calibre gun. So that's a 17-pounder. With a 4-man crew, as the increased size of the gun left no room for a co-driver.
There's just no room, is there? What's the intention of this gun? Why a 17-pounder?
Well, it's so that they can have a gun capable of knocking out the latest German tank designs, but also capable of firing HE shells some 10,000 yards.
Yeah, so this gun is just about capable of knocking out the Panther. Probably not the... But the thing is, the idea is you'd have one per troop and it would be called forward. We'll be dealing with all this when we get on to thing. How would you sum up the whole thing? Well, slowly but surely, the regiment is once again just about ready for its long overdue active service. What would you say was beckoning?
The Second Front.
And you've got a final quote now from Trooper Roy Valance, headquarters troop at this time, A Squadron. He'd been put in the bulldozer tank. So what does he say?
There were lots of rumours we were moving. We were quite happy there, and we were in no hurry to leave. But at the same time, most of the regiment had been training since 1939. And the feeling was, well, let's get it over, get it done, and get back home.
What? I think that sums up the attitude great. That people were worried, they're scared, but at the same time, they've been training a long time. They want to get out there, get it bloody over and done with, as he says. We'll be moving on to, they go overseas, and we'll be following the story of the 54 Fars, as they don't want to be called.
Well, I hope they don't have any dichotomies.
You mastered that word. Mastered it. Okay, thank you very much, Gary, for joining me, and thank you, me, for being me.
It's all dichotomy to me. Cheers, Pete.
Cheers.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from LA. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH, or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?